do, I don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. For the Lord's made a change in me.
This is Melissa. It is Real History, and it is the 11th of July, 2024. And I am going to give you a disaster mitigation episode today because I had recorded with Neil yesterday morning, the morning of Tuesday. It's Wednesday night right now when I'm recording this. And I said to him, you know, I'm going to try a different computer because my voice doesn't come through very well on this computer. No matter what I try, no matter how I play with the mixer, I just end up being very faint and then having to bump it up and I get distortion and so forth. So he said, okay. So we tried the new computer and it seemed to go well. And when I finally got around this evening to having time to edit it and start to make a video, I was pleased when I heard, oh yeah, there's my voice loud and clear. I won't have to bump it up or try to fix distortion or anything. But I skipped along and Neil's voice was nowhere on the recording. A real sad disaster because I thought we had a good conversation yesterday. So apologies to Neil and apologies to you that you're not getting that. I thought I would just mention quickly a few of the news pieces that Neil had brought to my attention, and I'll just go boom, 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 because frankly, nobody can give better comment to them than Neil himself. But if you want to check out a few of these stories, you can. The first humorous one from Technocracy News was, it's humorous but sad, and it's also indicative of the attack on the male-female relationship. But in Australia, they now have an official, and the department is Men's Behavior Change. So this official is going to officiate over changing men's behavior. For everybody's good, you understand. A really sad, angering story that he brought to my attention was about a 20-year-old German woman who ended up being imprisoned for several days because of hateful comments that she had made about a case that wrapped up in Germany. And just quickly, I'll post a couple of links to it, but quickly, what happened is that during COVID, during the lockdown, a group of teenagers got together in a park and they were drinking because, you know, teenagers, youth will be youth. And they were reported for breaking the social distancing lockdown law, rules, regulations, whatever. And so police came and broke it up and sent these young people home. Well, evidently, one 14-year-old girl was a bit inebriated, disoriented, got lost from her friends that she was with, and she ended up being raped by a group of people. I'll post the article so that you can read the details. And they not only raped her, they took film of it. They posted it to WhatsApp, I believe, was the application that they used. They invited other people to come over and participate in this gang rape. I think she somehow managed to get away from them and then was set upon by yet another group of two or three people, men who raped her. Now, the upshot of the story is that they made a lot of arrests. I think 8 or 9 men were arrested and charged. For whatever reason, some of them got off completely and others received a very light sentence. And so at the outcome of the case, there was a lot of anger amongst the German population. So I guess this 20-year-old woman posted some disgust, you know, she was disgusted by this. And her disgust was categorized as hate, and she ended up spending several days in jail. So I know. This is the world that we live in. A few other stories that Neil brought to my attention. There's something called Cognify, okay? Now, they say that Cognify is in the developmental stage. It's a prison concept to rewire the brain, a bit like a Clockwork Orange movie. What they can do, theoretically at least, although I think they're way past theory, is they can implant false memories. So, for instance, the person might have no recognition that he had ever raped someone. He might have no memory that he had ever desired to rape someone. So this is called Cognify, and I'll post an article on that. Neil and I had a lot of fun talking about Rishi Sunak just before he was voted out. I think maybe the day before or 2 days before the vote, some bright spark on his team had the idea for him to go on a morning television show. And he sat on a couch. You could see all this. He's sitting there waiting for his turn to be center stage on this morning show as the hosts of the show talked to Britain's most tattooed mom, a woman who is covered on her forehead up to her below her chin. The only part of her that doesn't have any tattoos are her cheekbones and her nose and her mouth, and I guess her eyelids. But she would appear to have had a bit of plastic surgery on the areas that were not tattooed. I think they said she'd had 45,000 pounds worth of tattoos, and Neil was having quite a bit of fun talking about silly Sunak, hands in pocket, looking a bit, well, silly. One story that we did not cover was that Finland is starting bird flu vaccinations for humans, and this is evidently a world first. Something that Neil commented on was that they're really beginning to push the COVID narrative again. He said, you know, it's the summer variants, and then you'll have the winter variants, you'll have the autumn variants. Booster. He sent me a video, and I'll link to that so that you can look at yourself. This old doctor who really looked like he needed to be on life support was talking to a news anchor lady saying, if you haven't had a booster recently, go and get a booster because it's the surge time. And that led Neil to talking about another article, and I think the primary source on this was the CDC, the at-home COVID-19 tests. And this was really hilarious, and I'm sorry that I cannot duplicate Neil's sense of humor because he had me in stitches. Reduce the risk of false negatives essentially by just continuing to test and test and test. If you get a negative test result, because, as they said here in this piece, this particular at-home test that we are selling you for a pretty penny, it's just not as accurate as what you might find in your doctor's office. So you might test negative and still have COVID. So just test again and again and again. And I did a little bit of fishing around to see what kind of a panic they were whipping up in the mainstream news. And there is quite a bit going on right now about there's a new variant. I mean, this is just so ridiculous, but there is a variant that they're calling Flirt. Scientists have cheekily nicknamed it Flirt. I guess that's the KP2 variant. And Flirt is drawn from the letters of the mutation. This is just a psyop, okay? It's a psyop. This is psychological warfare. And as I was thinking about that, I was thinking back to the episode that I did not very long ago with Mike up in Canada, Over the Mountain Part 2. And Mike had given this Part 2 of Over the Mountain the title, In the Beginning, there was 219-NCOVE. And he raised a lot of interesting questions, and he did an excellent presentation. I'm hoping that you have all had an opportunity to see that, and if you haven't, I will link to this. He also supplied a PDF breaking down all of the different links and of articles that he referenced, and it was just very well put together. He also, just as an aside, made a music video. He created a music video of the Supertramp song Crime of the Century, and the visuals that Mike put on that were incredibly moving and thought-provoking, and I will link to all of that again. But he mentioned a researcher named Catherine Watt in the context of a piece that she'd written entitled FDA, Food and Drug Administration, is a front organization. So after the conversation that I had with Neil, and then realizing I would not be able to give you that, I thought, well, what can I piece together here in the 11th hour when I don't really have time to do much of much? And so I went looking around for a little bit more that Catherine Watt might have to say that would be interesting. And she has some newer things, but I stumbled on something that was put up by Book of Hours. And Book of Hours, these are podcasters that I've actually done two real histories with, Julie and JP, husband and wife team. And so I'll give them credit for putting this together of Catherine Watt. But in January of 2023, she attended a press conference discussing the ongoing emergency use rollout of bioweapons being marketed as COVID vaccines. And she discussed in this little bit that I'm going to play the legal framework under which this happened, how many years it went back. And I'm just going to play a few minutes of it, 5, 6, 8 minutes, I don't know yet. But the piece that JP and Julie of Book of Hours put up is only about 16 minutes long, so it's worth watching the whole thing. And what I was struck by was her line of inquiry has inevitably led her to many of the conclusions that Alan Watt had so many years ago in terms of the Bank of International Settlements, what their role is, in other words, international bankers and all of this. And so I'll give you a few minutes of that. And I also thought, well, I was talking to Neil, and perhaps what I should do is just go back into the archives and find a little bit of a conversation that Neil had with Alan Watt that would apply to some of the topics here. And so I've chosen just the intro to the August 5, 2020 conversation that Alan Watt and Neil Foster had when Alan was a guest on Neil's radio program, Reality Bites Radio. And I'm just going to give you the intro to that. But again, if you want to hear the whole episode, it's a two-hour interview, and they get into COVID as a tool and excuse to accomplish an agenda and a complete revolution to bring in a new society. You are your own champion. That would be Alan. He often said that. And then Alan talks about listening to your sixth sense. So as I was thinking, what can I do? What can I bring you that would be interesting without much preparation? My mind wandered back to Dr. James Giordano. And it's been, I don't know, now I lose track of time, but a month and a half or so that I posted a Real History episode I think I entitled it, Who is Dr. James Giordano? And I had said a while back that I was interested in, you know, somehow covering questions that I had about surveillance technology and implantable surveillance technology, such as chips and nanotech and that kind of thing. So I did a little wandering around the internet, and I found a 35-minute talk, and I'm not sure if I'll play it all or just extract a little bit, but I do want to say something about this talk because I want to include a few additional articles, and I have some questions to put out there about this. But first of all, this was the Ethics Speaker Series. And again, this was at a Naval Academy. It didn't say which one, but it's the Ethics Speaker Series. And they brought Dr. Giordano there. He was speaking to a group of midshipmen, and those are people, men and women, who are training to become officers, Navy officers. So the title of his lecture was Big Data, AI, and Security/Defense on the Global Stage. Big data, this is straight out of Wiki, primarily refers to data sets that are too large or complex to be dealt with by traditional data processing application software. Data with many entries or rows offer greater statistical power, while data with higher complexity, more attributes or columns, may lead to a higher false discovery rate. Well, I think they just need to test their data again, eh? But there was a lot that he said that I found very interesting. I found myself having to stop this 35-minute talk repeatedly, back it up, listen again, look up other names and so forth. And at one point, he mentioned a colleague of his, Dr. Ofer Frieder, and he said, I don't use this term lightly, but Dr. Ofer Frieder is a genius, and he has been doing amazing things here. Dr. Ofer Frieder is at Georgetown University. He is a professor in the Department of Biostatistics, Bioinformatics, and Biomathematics, and Department of Computer Science. And evidently, the state of Florida, the Florida Inventors Hall of Fame, inducted him last year. And I'll put up a little video about that. But it says here in that video, Dr. Frieder developed a social media monitoring approach for depression detection and a patented, licensed, and proprietary intelligent agent that identifies behavioral deviancy, an early warning for potential mental health concerns. Now, I don't know about you, but that's scary to me. And then later on, he was talking about something that he had been involved in, and this was one I had to back up and listen to it again and then write it down. And I'm like, why isn't this easy? Because I simply couldn't find it from what he was saying. There were a couple things I could not find. But he was talking about nodes. And you'll see yourself, he has a chart, how these nodes interact with you in real time. So gathering information about you in real time that allows them, let's say for instance, the Chinese, you know, the enemy, to piece together in real time incredible information about you, you know, who your family is, how your genetics are affected by that. And he said, look, do you have a cell phone? Do you have any of your medical records been digitized? And how would you know, right? You go to the doctor, et cetera, et cetera. And he lists all of these instances that generate targeting nodes that allow bodies in real time to basically in that moment generate warfare, psychological or otherwise, that can be used on you, including your medical history. So I finally was able to, through some patience and so forth, find the program that he was talking about. It is TITAN. And TITAN stands for Tactical Intelligence Targeting Access Node. Now, listen to this. This project that Dr. James Giordano was involved in, TITAN, the U.S. Army has awarded Palantir the right to produce a next-generation targeting node known as TITAN. So this is what Giordano is involved in. This is from March of this year, this little piece here from a site I look at called Breaking Defense. Palantir wins contract for Army TITAN next-gen targeting system. Now, I knew that I had read a little bit about Palantir, and I certainly knew that Peter Thiel, of the one of the founders of PayPal, was behind Palantir. And in 2020, Alan linked to an article called Palantir's Tiberius Race and the Public Health Panopticon. The controversial data mining firm, whose history and rise has long been inextricably linked with the CIA and the national security state, will now use its software to identify and prioritize the same minority groups that it has long oppressed on behalf of the U.S. military and U.S. intelligence. That is a Whitney Webb article from, I've said it was Whitney Webb, yes, she co-wrote it with Jeremy Lofredo, and from her site Unlimited Hangout. And in 2023, October, There is another article by a different writer. I am not sure how to pronounce the name, but Stavroula Pabst. How Peter Thiel-linked tech is fueling the Ukraine war. Now, since I went down this line of thought about an hour ago, I haven't had time to read that, but we can read it together. I'll post that, and you'll have that there. But Peter Thiel he'll give you some pause. And when I was listening to James Giordano talk about TITAN and how neat it was, and then I found this article from an Army site, I read this article. And so you'll understand more when you listen to the bit that I post on Giordano. But it says that this is going to allow them to develop TITAN, a ground station used to connect Army units to high altitude and space sensors, which in turn provide targeting data to the soldiers. Bryant Chung is Senior VP for Defense at Palantir. He said, "We might be the first software prime, but we don't intend to be the only software prime. There is a viable pathway for more software firms to take the lead on Pentagon programs. We're thrilled to move into the next phase to deliver these revolutionary capabilities." Now, I want you to notice that when you look at the photograph, well, they say it's art. The art or photograph, the model, whatever it is, that was provided by Palantir of the TITAN system, it looks like a big truck, kind of a truck meets tank type thing. You know, the wheels are a truck, but the gear on top makes it, you know, I mean, it's a big, impressive truck. And so you think, oh, it's a truck with some weaponry on it. The goal is to make it easier for soldiers to identify, aim, and fire upon an enemy by fusing sensor data from various live sources. Palantir's big selling point was its use of AI to make that whole system run as smoothly as possible. that last point is key, as flooding soldiers with too much information to process doesn't benefit the mission. Titan greatly increases capability, but we want the software and AI to decrease complexity. We designed, now this part to me was key, so listen carefully. We designed the system to be modular. The key component is the software. Okay, that says everything. So just take it out of this big, clunky truck. The key component is the software. That means if soldiers decide a different ground vehicle is the way to go than what is currently being offered, the company believes it can be flexible and shift Titan to a different physical platform. That means that even though it looks like a truck, it's software. It's modular. They can use it anywhere. And Giordano made a big point of stressing, I think he called it the naked soldier problem or the naked player problem. I don't know. It's how do you track down somebody on which you have no data? How do you access that? How do you access it in real time? So I hope that you find all of this interesting as I cobble it together in some fashion quickly and slap a few pictures. I will rely on some of the pieces that I put in there. But I wanted to leave you with this. In the few minutes that I'm going to play of Catherine Watt, she talks about, I'm going to see if I can get back here where they've posted a little visual on here. And I can't find it, so sorry about that. But she is talking about warfare. And in this instance, she's talking about bio-warfare, right? But she describes in language that really reminded me of maybe how Alan would say, she does not confine this to a bio-weapon in a vial. But it's the whole package. It is the fear that is used on the public. She started off this little bit by showing the life cycle of a kill box, and this was a new discovery for her. But what she learned was the military creates a geographical space, so the kill box is not a real box. It is a planned space where warfare is going to be carried out. So at a certain stage, the kill box is cold. It's in the planning stage. And then it's in the active stage where they're using it. And then it can be canceled or dismantled. So this is the kill box and all of the different things that go into that. Now here I just found the words that she uses. The weapons are informational, psychological, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. But as she's talking, what she is talking about is how fear is such a critical component of this type of warfare. You must get boosted. There is a new variant. You have tested negative. Test again. Test again. These are all tactics of warfare. And when I was listening to the bit from James Giordano, he said something. And remember, the title was Big Data, AI, and Security/Defense on the Global Stage. So what does Peter Thiel do? Who is Peter Thiel? He's working with Palantir, and this is Big Data. This is from Wiki on Palantir. Just a little bit from this page. It specializes in software platforms for big data analytics, right? That's just too big. And it got the name from the Lord of the Rings, where the magical Palantiri were seeing stones. a type of indestructible ball of crystal to communicate and see events in other parts of the world. So this is all very exciting to Dr. James Giordano. And he has on his overhead projector, his little PowerPoint presentation, he is showing you the human loop. And he explained that in the human loop of AI, that the American model, but for sure the Chinese model of AI, is to completely remove the human from the loop. And he's saying it, you know, it hobbles the performance. In other words, if when you put a human in the loop, the reaction time is not what it needs to be, etc., etc. So with AI, the goal is, a human has to start the loop, but then the goal is to completely remove the human from the AI loop. And you get a much faster, much better performing system. And I was struck by the term that Dr. Giordano used. He said because they're going for pure cognition. So I just wanted to say that that I find knowing and learning to be a fear abatement, or the fear removal. It's my own fear removal kit. That combined with, you know, Alan in my head, and, you know, being your own champion and knowing, really knowing who you are, to be my most effective weapons against any kind of fear. And so when Giordano said, because AI delivers pure cognition, my immediate response was rubbish. No machine can do that. Pure cognition is purely human. Cognition is human. It is a mental action or process of acquiring knowledge and understanding through thought, experience, and the senses. Thank goodness for Wiki. But there you go. It's a mental action. And no matter how good computers are and what kind of data, big or otherwise, they're working with, computer does not have mental capabilities. Only humans do. So cognition is my ability to perceive. It's where I put my attention, my thoughts, how I think. It's my imagination, my intelligence, innate to me and developed by me. It is my ability to compute what is necessary for me in any given moment. My ability to problem solve or make a decision, to comprehend, to speak, to understand other people speaking. That is me. And you can sell me all day long on the joys of how a computer can do it. But one of the funny stories that Neil Foster was sharing with me was putting in a question to, he had typed in the date, what is the, when is Independence Day? And the reason why he wanted to know that was because he said his wedding anniversary was on the 5th of July. And so somehow he typed this in, 5th of July, Independence Day. And instead of it going in the regular search bar, it went into the little AI window, and he did not know that. And what AI spit back to him was, yes, the 5th of July is Independence Day. So this was Neil's humorous example of AI getting it wrong. But we're in this new fourth industrial revolution where everything is connected, everything is smart. This Ofer Frieder, who is the professor at Georgetown that Giordano referenced, he is in cyber research and the director of Cyber Smart, all caps, and a professor in the Department of Computer Science. So everything is smart, and it's interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary. It's bringing everything together because this global panopticon is the goal. But as scary as it is, when people start talking, as Giordano does in this 35-minute segment, about how easy it is to deliver nanotech in whatever form, right? Alan, somehow in his mind, I don't know how he knew this, but I certainly trusted it, and I still do. Some of us will come through, no matter how ugly it gets, no matter how much fear is applied to us, no matter how big data seems, and all of the weaponry that's coming at us from every direction. Some of us are going to make it through, and frankly, I believe it has a lot to do, not everything, with pure cognition, and that's you and me. Well, I'll give you some clips, and I will see you next week. I'll be back next week with someone from Australia that I'm looking forward to speaking with. His name is Carl, and he is an excellent musician, and I know it's going to be an interesting conversation, a longtime listener to Alan. And I have not spoken in real history to anyone from Australia yet. So I'm looking forward to it. And as we say in Texas, y'all take care.
No aliens. No nonsense. This is Reality Bites.
Welcome back to Reality Bites. A little bit later than usual, but we finally got a hold of Alan. He's had technical issues, as have we, which seems to be kind of normal these days. But a new normal, I guess.
That's it.
But, yeah. It's been a long time, Alan, since we had you on the air. I think maybe, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years,
probably.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, long time ago. I wanted to start off with something that's it's kind of affected Paula more than myself, because I get out of the house a bit more. But went to a city close to us, it's only about 20 minutes away, called Winterhaven. And they've had this face mask mandate in there for quite a while now, and I just hear another city close to us as well has just extended that for another month. And Paula was kind of horrified to see the compliance, not just in the stores, but actually on the streets in the open air. Virtually everybody was wearing masks, and I've been walking the last couple of mornings around the lake, and people are even wearing them at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, walking around in the fresh air. And it's, I guess it's a fear thing coming from both directions. These people are obviously being terrified by the television, as you've mentioned many times on your broadcast. Yeah. And there's got to be a fear amongst people who know what's going on and don't want to comply to this stuff, seeing the amount of compliance there is and knowing that these people are almost fanatical about it.
Yeah.
And they could turn on you at any minute. I mean, literally, I walked up behind two elderly ladies, I'd say, maybe early 60s. But they were obviously friends, they were talking, but they were still 6 feet apart. Yeah. And the path that I was walking on was maybe only 9 feet. So it was either walk on the grass, which was wet, or you know, walk around them.
Yeah,
and
sure.
The lady on the other side of the path, closest to the edge, literally saw me out the corner of her eye and dragged her friend away from me as I was walking by.
Uh-huh.
And I walked past shaking my head and just mumbling to myself, what is wrong with these people? Mm-hmm. But I can't even imagine that level of terror, because we don't watch television. We're not engaged with that kind of thing.
Exactly. That's the truth of it, sure. It isn't just the constant repetition of to be terrified. It's psychologically worked out. Every phrase that comes out from television on the subject, it goes through panels of psychologists and behaviorists to try and get the deepest impact or last, you see. And so literally it's a complete psychological warfare. Literally, it's not just coincidentally, it's actually worked out by panels how to terrify you.
Yeah, but and as I say, the fear is because like people like ourselves are in a very small minority. It would appear that you're constantly kind of watching your back. You don't know what these people are going to do.
Well, they don't know. They don't know themselves. They don't know themselves. See, it's literally Pavlovian responses based on basic terror and fear. It's again, it's psychological warfare. It works very well, and it's programmed them, you see, to react.
Yeah, after last week when Walmart, or maybe it was 10 days ago or so, Walmart decided they were going to mandate face masks, and so, you know, we started going to another store, but of course they followed suit a week later, so I thought, okay, well, and Walmart kind of backtracked a bit because they said their staff were getting too much abuse, and they wouldn't enforce it, so I thought, okay, I'll test that out. So I went up the first day they said this, and they've got a little gazebo style shade outside because it's 100 degrees, you know, and they've got somebody standing out there with one of these masks on, not a surgical, one of these really tight fitting ones.
Yeah.
And she's saying, you need a mask to go in there, sir. And I said, hold on a second. I said, CNN just announced yesterday that you weren't enforcing this, so you either believe in CNN or you don't. I said, quite frankly, I don't, but I mean, if that's what they're saying, then right. I guess that's true. And she started mumbling, and there was a guy next to me with his wife and a young child, and he didn't have a mask on either. And he said to her, he said, I've got COPD, can I get an exemption? And she said, yes. She didn't ask the wife. he starts walking off, and I turned to her and said, don't you dare ask me if I've got a medical condition.
Yeah.
I said, because I'll sue you. And she just kind of made a face, and then she said, they'll stop you at the door. I said, no, they won't. So I just walked straight in, and nobody bothered me.
Yeah.
But just yesterday, I went up again, and they've got somebody standing outside the door now, and they're using the older people, the older members of staff, the ones with a bit more gravitas, I guess. And she's standing like a paramilitary, literally, with her legs spread, hands folded behind her back, and she's got a bandana on.
Uh-huh.
All that's missing was a machine gun.
That's
you know. And she says, don't forget your mask, sir. And I said, I've forgotten already. And I just kept walking. And there's two of them inside, standing. And one of them shouts across me, have you got a mask, sir? And I said, no. And I just kept walking. I answered her question. I was quite civil and walked in the door. But they're ramping up this intimidation, if you like, to get a reaction from you. Because they want that reaction to turn around and say, well, you're not coming in here because you're just belligerent, blah, blah, blah. You're abusing the staff.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the way they're going with this, rather than actually enforcing it. Although tomorrow in our city, we're supposed to have a decision made on whether we're to wear masks outdoors 24/7. It's just insane. But there's little protests about it, but I don't see it changing. But
it won't change because it's nothing to do with reality. Literally nothing. And I won't even go into all the pros and cons or anything else, because I've done, you know, ad nauseum. But the fact is, it's got nothing to do with COVID. It's part of a complete revolution to bring in a complete new society. And this is all part of it. You're also getting the same from internet and from social media, we're going to ban you because you broke some taboos or whatever of their policies. And this is the same thing with the stores. Oh, you won't comply. Well, you can't shop you. This is the new system where you do what you're told. It's post-democratic, you see. And the COVID idea is just the way they launched it. They World Economic Forum said that they couldn't get the public to comply fast enough with using the climate change agenda and cut back on consumerism and so on. So they're actually applauding it, this whole idea of using COVID. They're actually out in the open saying this. It's even the Club of Rome. So it's part of a bigger agenda.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's still people here who think that it's all going to go back to normal in November after the election.
Never. Whatever Fauci said back in February, you can take it to the bank if any bank's left standing. But the fact that he said that, says nothing's going to ever go back to normal, nothing. And you heard the same thing right after 9/11, that before the dust settled, you know, they're announcing it from CNN, nothing will ever be the same again. Same thing here. This is a new way of living. Or existing, I'd call it, you know, where you can't do anything without experts running your lives from birth to death. This is it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even now, and it's as bad as it is, you can still kind of get around and do the basics, you know. But I mean, the way it's going, you're not going to be able to leave your house.
I don't even sit and speculate where it's going, because I've read all their stuff and they admit where it's going quite openly, and Fauci again said it never been done in history this way. When you close down all the healthy and quarantine the healthy folk, that guarantees a very, very slow herd immunity, you see. He doesn't want herd immunity. He said at the beginning, he said, it won't be good enough. You must take the vaccination to get out of your homes and to get to go to work. That's the whole thing, the immunity passport. An agenda that was published years ago by the same characters, you know. Your immunity passport. So this is it. It was all set to go this way, and they needed an excuse for it, and they picked this COVID idea.
People used to think, they could really release something deadly, blah blah blah. But they didn't have to. They just had to pretend it was deadly, and that was good enough.
Well, not only that. I mean, I did the talks many years ago from the World Health Organization, where they admitted. And folk laugh at you, even when you're reading their articles from their own websites and so on, and sending offer stuff from the WHO. They'll post it to you if you pay the money, you know. But they said that they said at the time that every spring, early spring, even before the spring hits, they release a trial flu into society to see how it spreads, which direction it takes, and all the rest of it, and so they can monitor it. It's an experimental spread, they called it. Of a tamer type of the flu, they let go into the society. This is from their own articles, you know. And so you say, where does the flu come from? Well, they release it, and then you follow the spread and see how the directions of contamination and all the rest of it. There's nothing. Our reality has to get turned upside down. It really does. Most folk have been trained to be naive from birth. And they'll never get it. They can never break. They crash. They break down and quiver and be gibbering idiots if they had to really be forced to see the world as it really is. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah, we have a van driving around town, which we spotted with some writing on the window saying that, you know, TV is a virus, blah, blah, this is all a con, this type of thing. I was like, oh, great, you know, maybe we can give them a newspaper and maybe like-minded people, you know. So we drove up to where we thought it was. We found it, and a lady just happened to be outside. So we stopped, went over, had a chat, gave her the paper. And again, it was, well, Trump won't let this happen after November. And I'm thinking, this woman's supposed to be awake, but she's still stuck in this political paradigm where she thinks that Trump's going to stop it. Well, he's not stopped it yet.
Oh, Trump has. Trump wasn't put in there for American people. He was put in there for somebody, but not for the American people. You know?
Well, I think he was put in there to be held up and ridiculed myself, because
I think they're all playing their part. I really do.
Yeah.
I think each one is playing their part, because no one is going following right through with the part that you'd think they'd play. Trump is watching cities burn and saying nothing. Well, I mean, would you vote for him?
Would you vote at all? that's a question.
Well, I've never voted. I don't believe in it.
But
the thing is, I mean, Trump literally, he says a lot, but he does nothing. You know. He tweets a lot like a little bird, and that's all.
Well, I always say that to people as well. I say, do you really think that these people are sitting about tweeting folks? I mean, come on. No. But it's a few people have heard say, oh well, but come November this will all go away.
Fauci said it, this little dictator. I mean, he's a front man for a much bigger organization, much, much bigger, you know. The world has a global government already. It's had it for a long, long time. And it's been fairly quiet. They don't want to push too hard and fast over the world. But the fact is, this is, whatever happens, and I said this 25, 30 years ago, whatever happens policy-wise in your country, and even with whatever happens social-wise, happens across the world at the same damn time. Well, how can that be when you're all got different kinds of governments and different kinds of social structures? No, you don't. They're all standardized and run by global committees. That's the truth of it.
Yeah. I mean, talk about things spreading. I mean, I can't believe that people actually think that there's 10,000, 20,000 new cases in Florida every day of the week, and this is somehow spreading.
I could get you 100,000 tomorrow, 100,000 test kits. Because it's nothing to do with suddenly folk getting sick and going, no, they're expanding testing throughout society. They've got them in the street corners in some cities, begging folk to get tested. Yeah. And because COVID, there's all kinds of COVID viruses out. They've been around for millions of years. You generally never know they're going through you. Because herd immunity spreads so fast, within a 2 weeks you get total herd immunity if you don't lock the folk down. I mean, Sweden's got about 80 to 85, almost 90% herd immunity. Follow the lockdown, you see.
Yeah, my friend's actually living there at the moment, and I sent him the things that BBC had put out about how the bars are coping with this and blah blah, all the social distancing and the screens up. He says none of that's happening. That's just nonsense. He says that's garbage, all of it. Sure. And nobody's wearing masks, so they're all just acting as if nothing's happened.
Yes.
But the
agenda is to destroy everybody's economy to bring in the new system. And it's a strange thing. I gave these talks back in the 90s. And it's the same thing with the World Bank at the top, and sure enough, they come out in the last few days talking about restructuring and locking down America for another 6 weeks to save what's left of the financial system. That's what they said yesterday, from the World Bank. Do you vote for the World Bank? No, this is a private institution, isn't it? Like all these organizations are privately owned. Same with the IMF. We fund them, mind you, but they're owned privately. And the Bank for International Settlements, the same group that was set up by the Royal Institute for International Affairs after Lord Milner created that organization. So, I mean, it's the same damn thing, and Carl Quigley said it too. Eventually, the World Bank and the Bank for International Settlements will rule the world. Well, bingo. Here's your excuse to do it openly.
Yeah.
Part of the technocracy too. Because they've been saying forever, this democracy is such, especially the Club of Rome, and their different books they've put out there, and the Global Revolution, First Global Revolution, and so on. They said it, that democracy doesn't work for the elite, because you have to cater to the public's opinion all the time, and they can't get things done fast enough and efficiently enough, so... They're pushing for a post-democratic system. That's always been their goal. Well, here it is. With COVID, you've got the experts ruining your lives now, from birth to death. And I'm sure they'll speed up the deaths, too, with the vaccinations. Fauci pretty well said that, too. 700,000 folk across the world will die of it, of the vaccination. Well, you know.
Gates said the same thing as well.
It's the whole agenda. This is it. And out of it, come this winter, you're going to see famines.
This is part of
what they want. They want famines and rationing, a full-scale war-type scenario with rationing. I gave the same talk back in the 90s in Jackie Petruccio. And I said, and here we are, it's all coming to pass, because this isn't a new agenda. They just took off the old scrolls and blew the dust off them and presented them to the public. They've been trying to get this one to go for years.
Do you think there are some genuine people out there who actually are starting to think, in the political spectrum, if you like, that hold on a minute, this is going too far?
Sure. Oh, there's a few of them, but unfortunately they're small countries. You know, the global elite with their massive intelligence network system. And don't forget, the NSA is part of it, so is Facebook and all the rest of them. They're all part of the intelligence agency. They're all fronts, you know. They've got the whole Western world, they've got the so-called top countries totally under their control. The occasional country that's not quite under their belt, even some of the African countries can come out quite openly and say this is a con and speak openly about it. Like the guy who tested his fruit and goats and even motor oil and sent it off to the World Health Organization laboratory, and they all came back positive for COVID. You know, I mean, so yeah, it's a complete con.
Yeah, well,
this is total war. This is a complete war campaign on the public.
Yeah, well, if you lock people indoors all summer and they have no vitamin D uptake, yeah, then they're going to get rickets.
Yes, they will. And if they're already pouring millions of gallons of milk down the drain, superior vitamin D, you know, and so on, and they're ploughing potatoes under just like they did in the 1930s when Roosevelt was in. And, they're getting all set for the same scenario.
Yeah. Well, I mean, come the winter, Britain's already said that they're going to have the biggest flu vaccine rollout in the history of vaccines. And, of course, Fauci's saying, well, you've got to get a flu jab to protect you from COVID. And I just got an article, was it today or yesterday? Yesterday, yep. I think it was, from the CDC. And they said that there's going to be... it's imminent that there's going to be many cases of childhood death due to acute flaccid myelitis, which is polio, of course, or a form of polio. Yeah. And
after they gave the folks the polio shots and folks still got paralysed, they just changed the name. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do they know? I mean, is that coming in the flu jab? I mean, who would know?
Well, that's it. Again, depends who's giving you what kind of flu jab as well. And don't forget, these are primers. They're pulmonary primers, these jabs. The Department of Defense, I've mentioned this before, 2017-18, suddenly panicked in the U.S. And told me to cease all the flu shots, because when the folk actually got the shots in the military... And then hit a wild virus afterwards. They were coming down with a massive cytokine storm, you know, and it was killing them. So the hand in Canada too were told, oh, you cease it a few years ago. A sudden panic when they realized that folk were dying at the dam because of the flu shot. It caused a cytokine storm when you hit the actual real virus itself in the wild. They call it wild virus. And it's like all these vaccinations, what they tell you initially, they always give you the same glowing report. I mean, this rubber stamp, they've got the same characters writing the reports over and over. The CBC did documentaries on this years ago, like 60 Minutes did it too. And they showed you these guys in the shadows, you know, who write up all these fantastic glowing reports and stamp them and get paid big money to lie. But they always tell you, the initial results are so promising because the people have got antibodies after they get the shots, no matter what it's for. But then when you hit the actual real virus, or a different kind of similar virus that's from the wild, right, and within about a month or 2 months or 3 months after it, you have this massive overreaction and your own antibody system overproduce and kill you. That's a fact.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that's...
So I don't trust any of... I had that. I almost died in 2016. But I had it before that, years ago, when I got a whole bunch of boosters. I was going abroad, you know. And literally within 2 or 3 weeks, I had incredible pneumonia. I had rheumatoid arthritis that came on me. I had high fever with it. My joints all suddenly swelled up. And I had sonophils in my lungs, you know. That's a sign that you have with a cytokine storm. I had all this, because of these bloody, vaccinations that they gave me, it almost killed me. I was very lucky to survive it. But definitely, my bones got almost destroyed with it. No doubt about that, too. And then take this stuff.
Yeah, I remember you actually saying at the time they were trying to get you to sign a DNR.
That's right.
Yeah. Talking of that, again, one of Paula's relatives, I'm not going to say who it is, but recently I went to hospital for some treatment, and twice he tested her for COVID. She was twice negative, surprisingly, going by the tests. But they still tried to put her in the COVID ward, even although she was negative, and with a suppressed immune system. And there's only one result going to happen there.
Of course, but, they've actually had published reports of that same thing happening in Britain.
Yeah, and
where they're putting them in. A lot of folk literally haven't had it until they're put in these wards, and within about 2 weeks they get it naturally, just like the cruise ships, you know.
And the care homes, of course.
Yeah.
There was an article this week, I think, stating that people in care homes were basically thrown to the wolves. Well, that's a perfect description, really, because that's what these people are, as wolves.
And incredible financial gain from it, too. You know, because if they put down COVID, I mean, the government immediately throws thousands of bucks at them per patient, you know. For claiming that they've got COVID, and in the US especially, with was it $40,000 if they get them on a ventilator as well?
That's right.
So again, we could bitch forever about the signs and symptoms of this of the con game here, but the fact is, it's for a bigger goal, and the goal is a permanent goal of retraining the whole population of the planet into sustainability, as they call it. Post-consumerism, and right down to who will, they said at the last big climate meeting last year, it's time to decide who can have children and who can't have children. That old agenda. So that's coming along the pike very, very nicely, as you say. Yeah.
So take care, as I say, keep rebelling if you can.
And the basic idea is that public health has been militarized, and the military has been sort of turned into a public health front or Potemkin village, such that they are using public health language and public health laws to actually carry out a military campaign. And I would not call them DOD vaccines. I would call them DOD weapons. So I call it the kill box because the first sort of lead that I had was Todd Callender's January 30th, 2022 interview on Elizabeth Leavitt's podcast called Truth for Health. And he described it as a kill box. And then I looked that up, and it turns out it's a military term for establishing a geographic space or three-dimensional area for a military attack by air and by surface to kill the people who are in it and then dismantle the kind of framework and move on to the next campaign. And what the DOD and the World Health Organization intend to do and have gotten quite far in doing, but not completely reached their goals, is to set up the entire world as their geographic terrain, their target population as all the people in the world, the duration of their campaign as permanent, and the weapons that they're using are, number one, informational, that's the propaganda piece and the censorship piece, number two, psychological, that's the fear and terrorism piece of telling people they need to be afraid all the time and they need to listen to the government. And then the third piece is the chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons, which are called in their campaign pharmaceuticals, vaccines, but are actually toxins and pathogens. So I started, after I heard that interview, I had already been wondering what was going on, but I started trying to track down some of the things Todd Callender talked about in his interview and figure out what the legal frameworks were and how they were set up and what the financial coercion mechanisms were. My finding, which many other people have found in various other angles, was that this project has been going on for centuries. It's basically globalist central bankers and lots of related organizations trying to get complete control of human beings through banking programs and through military programs. And they kicked it into higher gear in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act. And then they kicked the public health aspect of it into higher gear starting in the 1930s and 40s. Before the 1960s, they mostly did it through orchestrated armed conflicts and financial depressions and wars, which are very loud and messy and destructive to infrastructure, and it makes it difficult for them to have plausible deniability and legal impunity for what they're doing. So in the mid-60s, they got much better at inducing suicide and homicide by fraudulently labeling poisons as medicines or as vaccines or as prophylactics and telling people that submitting to that poisoning process was their civic duty. And that's, we saw that in COVID with the shorthand for do this or you're going to kill your grandma. And the way that the pharmaceutical method is primarily useful to them is that plausible deniability is much easier and legal impunity is a lot easier. They can achieve the same goal of killing lots of people without their fingerprints being all over it. I looked into the coercion cascades, mostly financial. Not going to go into a lot of detail with that, but it starts at the top with the Bank for International Settlements, and they can use their control of other federal central banks' access to financial systems, and then all the way down through state governments, national governments, local, municipal, school districts, hospitals, everything. If you comply with what they're telling you to do, as far as masking and testing, isolating yourself, taking injections, then you will get the financial access that you need to run your business or to have a job. And if you don't comply, they can cut you off from those services. And so that is one of the main mechanisms through which the whole thing was carried out. And then on the legal side, at my website, I do trace it back farther, but I'm going to start at 1969 just for the sake of starting somewhere. The U.S. Congress passed a law to set up the Chemical and Biological Warfare Program. And in that law, which is 50 U.S.C. Chapter 32, there are very important key terms, including protective, prophylactic, and defensive, which is how they justified doing it. They were using those words because the international community of ordinary, non-insane people were concerned about biological and chemical weapons, and they were working on international treaties to prohibit them. And so they needed to build in loopholes, and the loopholes they built in were, we're not going to do biological and chemical research and weapons development except for protective or prophylactic or defensive purposes. And that's a false characterization because all biologically active products are intrinsically aggressive and toxic and lethal. And that's where we get disciplines, or that's the thing that disciplines like toxicology, pharmacokinetics, genotoxicity, drug-drug interactions are all related to that fact that everything that goes into the human body or any living body has some effects which can be toxic. So that was the way they tried to get around that. And then the foundational public health emergencies platform came out in 1983 when Congress passed the Public Health Service Act amendment, and that set up the Public Health Emergencies Program under the 1944 law that had originally set up the Public Health Service, which is a branch of the military. And it also, in 1983, Congress and Reagan set up a $30 million slush fund, and that has continued. It's got a different name now than it did then, but it's still being funded as recently as the NDAA and the Consolidated Appropriations Act in December 2022. The other thing they did in the 80s was set up the 1986 National Vaccine Program and National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And that's the one that set up the liability exemption for manufacturers and funneled anyone who was injured by a vaccine into this different compensation program. And that's been used as a model since the COVID started for the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program. So the international piece, the cornerstone, is the World Health Organization, which is not a health organization. It's a military organization because of this merger that I'm talking about. It's sort of the military arm of the one world government that they're trying to set up. And they did a set of amendments to the international health regulations in 2005 that entered into force in June 2007. But basically, the IHR, which are currently going through another round of amendments to make them worse, called on national governments to strengthen their own domestic laws and fund more programs for surveillance, testing, detention and quarantine, physical control, and forced treatment during international outbreaks of communicable diseases. And the pretext that they used, because it was bankers who were doing this, was that they needed to protect international trade from disruptions caused by disease outbreaks. But the real intent was to set up these legal systems that transfer sovereign government from the nation state to the World Health Organization and the BIS automatically when a public health emergency of international concern has been declared and Congress and U.S. presidents and the cabinet complied with that demand from the World Health Organization. So two of the key years were 1997 and 98. That was when the beginnings of the Emergency Use Authorization Program was set up and when they transferred the CBRN weapons stockpile from DOD classification, I guess, to HHS or CDC classification and control. It was the same products, as far as I can tell. It was just a relabeling and a rehoming of them. And the EUA, that was kind of a two-step thing. At the time, the public was really upset about the use of unapproved vaccines for anthrax on military troops and the horrible adverse effects they were having. So Congress passed a law in November to kind of revoke authorization for testing or using unapproved products on military troops. But 3 days later, in a different law, made it so that the same programs could be done, but the target population would be expanded from just military troops to the entire American population. Then, around 2000 to 2002, using the momentum from 9/11 and the anthrax attacks on Congress, they set up, through the statutes again, program management sort of structures. They did that through the 2000 Public Health Threats and Emergencies Act, through the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force. And people talked about this at the time. It was construed as putting the country into a permanent state of war, the global war on terror, with every other country in the world. So there was no geographic limitation. There was no time limitation. There was no identified enemy other than terror. And through that, I think other people figured this out at the time, and then it sort of got suppressed. But it made everyone in the world into a presumptive combatant or enemy target. So it was essentially a de facto covert global martial law act by the U.S. government. And then in those early 2000s, we also got the Patriot Act, the Public Health Security and Bioterrorism Preparedness and Response Act, and the Homeland Security Act. And those were just more of the merging of the DHS, the DOJ, the HHS, the Department of Defense, all of the cabinet agencies.
So what I want to talk to you about is basically what we see here on the slide. I usually impugn anyone who would read a slide directly. You can. But I want you to read the slide by virtue of the intersection. They are not mutually exclusive topics, nor are they mutually exclusive in their iteration and their effect. We cannot do much of what we do in the biomedical sciences that are becoming ever more important to biosecurity, biointelligence, and biodefense without big data and some iteration of what's now being called AI. And what I want to be able to do is parse some of those things out and demonstrate to you this is a situation of right hand washing left hand and both washing the face. And it's also a question of whatever you want to put on your face. So this is infinitely corruptible. What I want you to take from the get-go is that all of these sciences have come together under a rubric that is now formally referred to as integrative scientific convergence. And as such, what we tend to do is now take these domains of science and clump them into functional S&T. So as you go through your respective careers, and for those of us who already are advanced in our careers, you're seeing the S&T moniker far more in a much diverse palette of utilization and real meanings. So whenever you see the S&T as the suffix, prefix that with whatever they have there and recognize this represents an integration of the science and the tools. And the reason for that is this is the big triune. There's a task sitting out there. What is the task? Whatever it could be. Do we have tools in our current armamentarium to be able to meet that task? Yes or no? Based upon that, in engaging that task, what do we know about that stuff? That becomes the theory. We come to the limits of those theories, boom, we need new tools. And then what ends up happening is those tools then allow us to reappropriate the task and reorganize the theory. So this idea of tasks, tools, and theory is very much like a three-partner dance, but can also be considered as part of the proverbial three-body system in physics that leads to particular imbalancing. As tools become more apparent, we make some tasks up for them. As we have tools that provide particular theoretical discretion, it then offers our capability to go deeper into certain tasks and back out of others. And the absence of certain tools in the face of tasks and theory, or the absence of theory, prompts us to make various tools anew. In other words, what you tend to see is an iterative and escalative use of theory and tools to be able to accommodate a range of tasks. This area, integrative advanced scientific convergence, a term first coined by Professor Ashok Vashasta, formerly at State Department, then doing a lot of deep intel work with DOD, now up at Rutgers University, recognizes that it brings together all of the sciences in a disiloed way. One of the problems with the sciences and other fields has historically been that they exist within a rather insular solipsistic science and or silo. I can tell you that from my own experience. I've been doing this academic thing for 42 years this year. And it was very easy early on to exist relatively in that silo, unpack what you had, and then hand it off. But increasingly, this task, theory, and tool interface is demanding, at very, very least, some diffusion between the silos, and more, a de-siloing altogether, which then opens up the opportunity space, the challenge space, the problem address and solving space, but also the problem space. Much of the problem has been that the information that is gained from one silo, domain or dimension, is not necessarily tractionable or palatable within the other by virtue of scale, level, focus, nexus, etc. What has made that far more accomplishable and realistic has been this thing called big data. And depending on who you talk to, big data is a thing or they are things. Yes, data are always plural. For the middies in the room, whenever you use the word data, put your pinky up in the air and always refer to it in the plural. People think you're educated. But big data is a singular thing. And what that singular thing is an enterprise, an edifice, in which various types of data acquisition, utilization, synthesis, dissemination, and increasingly security, ethics, and social issues are being addressed. You cannot do integrative scientific convergence without big data, because it allows the relative translatability and therefore tractionability of these different disciplines and the type of information they acquire to be shared, assimilated, synthesized, and utilized in relatively real time across massive scopes of data, levels of data, and this allows what we call the multiple V approach. Validity, veridicality of data, viability of volumes of data with high velocity, which all increases its value. But you can't do big data without some form of machine learning or decision technologies. And unfortunately, what's happened is the term AI has slipped into colloquialism within our general community parlance. Let me sort of dissect that a little bit for you, because I think by dissecting it, we can be far more specific as to where the benefits, burdens, and potential risks lay. Work from the bottom up. Deep learning represents not only a technique, but a series of technologies that allows us to essentially do as the slide does. It trains algorithms and systems by means of what's called neural network morphologies that are integrated. The way these basically work is they start out with a broad, broad range of inputs that then funnel down in a somewhat pyramidal state and then allow that to then invert and go from a narrow, narrow focus to be able to get some information across a broad range of potential outputs. There's a lot of data exchange that occurs there. They're modeled on neurological systems across a variety of species, from literally sea slugs to humans. The more human they get, the more you get into something more like machine learning, where now a machine system acquires particular attributes, skills, talents, directionalities that a human user would imbue upon that system based upon the way you want the machine to learn to do things that are necessary for human cognitive, motoric, behavioral, or some other effectual end. Very often, these two things are not mutually exclusive. Machine learning and some form of directed deep learning work together, and when you couple them together, you get primary AI, primary artificial intelligence. And so, again, a formal definition for artificial intelligence is that it's an intelligent system that does so by way of some non-human interfacing of multiple systems of nodes and networks. The question is, how artificial is artificial? And what does artificial mean? Artificial not real, or artificial like artifice? And what we're finding is that if you take a look at this space, and this is the definable space, these things, again, are not mutually exclusive. So what we're using is more and more systems that incorporate a deep learning parameter, certain machine learning parameters to then have hierarchical and integrated deep learning, all of it fitted within what is necessarily AI. What this allows is this: a tremendous amount of informational capability, access, accessibility, affectation, use across domains. What are those domains? Look, it's all here. This interesting little diagram, which is microscopic to you, provides for you, if you will, the edifice of the way integrative scientific convergence has been realized, actualized, by the integration of both big data and various forms of deep learning, machine learning, and iterative progressive forms of AI. From relatively soft AI, which is these types of deep learning systems taken alone, to ever more autonomous and independent systems, which is harder AI, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you can see how this capacitates what we're able to do with information. It goes from the cellular to the social, from the individual to the international, across viable scales, across time spans, and allows for the integration of those data in ways from which meaning and representation of patterns can be extracted, either by the machine system and or by the human user. So there are two ways to do that. One is we can set up the machine system to be essentially agnostic. Look for some patterns here, and it'll pull those patterns out. The other is to be more Gnostic. Look for this pattern, and it will do that. And of course, these are the domains and dimensions that are capable, given these tools that we have at our discretion. Let me put this into some real-world findings for you. What you have before you here is something called a von Mueller nodogram. A von Mueller nodogram. It's based upon a computational node network system originally developed at the Parmenides Institute in Germany by Professor Albrecht von Mueller, working with a neuroscientist named Dr. Ernst Pöppel. And what this essentially does is this takes integrations of various types of data and brings them together in essentially a nodosphere. In other words, a sphere, an environment, an ecology of nodes that interconnect these data in usable ways. The one thing I've tried to do over and over again is try to get a slide that moves in three dimensions. I'm lucky I can get the damn PowerPoint up, so you'll have to just apologize for the fact that this is a singular dimensional slide. The way the nodogram works is fascinating because it takes each one of these domains not as circles but as spheres. And the contribution to that sphere is the acquisition of both prior as well as real-time data. All of these data. Historical data. Phenomic data, in other words, what is the physical nature of you? Genotypic data, what is not only your genome and your genetics, but those of your historical family, those of those individuals who may influence your epigenome, in other words, what are your ecological and genetic interfaces? What are your medical economics? What are you buying at the drugstore? What prescriptions do you have? How are you using your social media, your public media? What are you reading? What are you downloading? What are you looking at your computer? What are your various contacts, both personally and professionally, and then ultimately using all of these to track your behaviors and from them map your cognitions in real time. In real time. A colleague who I work with, and I don't use this word ever cavalierly, truly a genius, named Professor Ophir Frieder at Georgetown, has taken the idea of the von Mueller nodogram and has utilized this for a way of naked person tracking. So if you know anything about human terrain teams in this dimension, in the DoD dimension, or in the IC dimension, whether it's Title 50 or Title 10 applications, you know that one of the most difficult things is naked person tracking. How do we literally follow somebody without having identifiable characteristics that we can tag? Several years ago, our research group developed something called Titan, which was tiered, integrative tag and analytic networks. But you still needed a tag. Still had to put something on that individual to be able to know where they were. Chip them the way you would your kitty cat or your dog. Now, can we do that? Yeah, we can. And all conspiracy theories aside about what happened yesterday on your cell phone, graphenes and nanobots aside, the truth of it is that we can. The real issue is we can introduce nanomaterials to you, to individuals, in a rather inconspicuous, if not clandestine, if not covert way, that are then trackable. Trackable across domains and dimensions from the cloud. And or from a satellite. But we still have to introduce the nanomaterials to you. Are there ways to do that? Yes. Some of them remain on the high side. Some of them not so much, because this is now getting out of the public domain. But let's sort of take a step back. Let's say there's something sniffy about that. Oh, that's just a little too much Big Brother stuff. Well, we don't have to introduce anything to you to tag you and track you. You're doing it all yourself. I guarantee you're doing it all yourself. How many people in this room have one of these things? Got a GPS in your car? Ever order anything online? Go to the drugstore, they have your prescription, boom, there you go. And heaven forbid you use one of these situations like 23andMe or one of the other gene trackers. Good luck. All that information is out there. You have an electronic medical record? Look. You buy things? You talk to people? There it is. And this moves three-dimensionally based upon what inputs, A, we're looking at, and B, what inputs are changing in real time, so as to be able to provide a three-dimensional locus view of you that is patterned, physically patterned, as to what you're doing as these data evolve for you. Now, the reason I tell you that is you could imagine that this has a tremendous boon in a number of different viable applications, low-hanging fruit being benevolent. Medicine, various forms of social tracking, various forms of prospective tracking individuals in terms of risk factors, burdens, threats within their various environments. Certainly we can see this being used in combat scenarios so as to be able to provide what we call, in our research group, hope, health, operational protection, and enablement to do that job well and come back and survive. We can do that. We talk about a variety of preemptive risk factors. Can we now look at these things in advance and keep you as far out of harm's way as we possibly can? Both by virtue of where we deploy you, how we deploy you, what we billet you into, literally segueing you into those particular billeting codes and those job spaces that are going to be most ideal and suited for what it is you're going to do, and ultimately it's going to be a best need to the service, if not the country at large. But we're not the only ones doing it. In fact, if you take a look at current dedication of gross domestic products to these areas of scientific and technological development that are focused into these exact silos that I've just spoken, the United States is actually number two. Now, number one, we have number one in terms of our overall scientific and technological gross domestic product investment. We are followed closely, only $6 trillion off U.S. dollars differential by China. And if we actually examine how these key areas of large-scale financial investment are being channeled into key areas, domain areas, that are representative of what I've just spoken to you about, the interface of big data, AI, and those things that have some form of, I'm going to drop a philosophical term, stand by, here it comes, biopower influence. For those of you who have a little bit of philosophical reading under your belt, French existential phenomenological philosopher Michel Foucault referred to biopower. Exercising power by being able to gain insight and develop dependencies with individuals' biological necessities and essences. So in other words, there's something you need or something you are biologically, you need it, I got it, I got you. Now, what does this mean? What this means is that much of the edifice of American S&T that are dedicated to these enterprises is oriented towards playing some form of catch-up. We're not number one. It's a precarious race. Right now, it's a photo finish, a Formula One photo finish. And in fact, we've used that analogy that this is very, very similar to a Formula One race. Big prizes, not only in terms of the money you're going to make by being able to utilize these in leveraging various markets, but big prizes of capability as well. High, high speed. Huge high speed. The capitalization of being able to do big data with AI and a variety of applications that interface individuals' physical reality, their safety, their public health, ergo biosecurity and biodefense, is now moving ahead in quantum jumps every 48 calendar months. Break, break. Here in the United States, probably one of the most avant-gardistic research approaches to these types of things is exercised by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA. As you may know, DARPA utilizes something called the Heilmeier Catechism. What works, what doesn't. Why doesn't it work? Where doesn't it work? What's wrong with it? How much would it cost to fix it? And what's going to be the net profit gain across a number of viable domains as identified? That's the Heilmeier Catechism. According to that Heilmeier Catechism, utilizing those five principles allows us to then articulate that change from idea to instrument, from concept to construct in 5 calendar years, 60 calendar months. Our Trans-Pacific near-peer competitor has an organization called Wing Chewei Jiwei. Anybody who speaks any form of Chinese, any one of the dialects, probably just going, God, no, that's not how you say it. But basically, it is a DARPA mimetic outfit. It took the DARPA model and incorporates it within the very seamless triple helix of Chinese political infrastructure, which is government, the research enterprise, which is academia, and the commercial sphere, so as to utilize those as a triune, which then pushes things through that system quick, quick. How much quick, quick? 42 calendar months. And if you think the difference between 60 calendar months and 42 calendar months ain't spit, you're wrong. That provides a considerable window of opportunity to be able to put a product or service or function out there, alpha, beta test it, utilize it in an employable way, and then retract it to watch what response is, and then modify it very, very quickly. So that flexibility imparts fixity of purpose in a great way. And as you can see from this, realistically, that is then going to be capabilized within the next 3 to 5 years. There's nothing implicit about that at all. The Chinese government has come forth and said that realistically by the year 2049, a sentinel year historically, they will be the international leaders in science and technology, particularly with what they call biopolitical applications in markets, in tourism space, in research sharing space, to basically capitalize the global market on bioscience and tech. And their bioscience and tech is critically reliant upon big data and AI, as we see here. However, what you need to understand is this is a two-sided blade, folks. Any of these things that I just described being capable to do this kind of stuff, to hit the benevolent, low-hanging, beneficent fruit of those things that are going to be good for you, can also be used in ways that might be burdensome for you, risky for you, threatening to you, harmful for you. The more I know about you, the more I can develop stuff like precision pathologies. The more I know about where you're going to be in the next 10 minutes, the more I can put myself there. The more I know what affects you cognitively, emotionally, behaviorally, based upon those patterns of your big data and the integrative algorithms that I'm able to generate about you, or as used to say in my hometown back in New York, all yous, individually or collectively, the more I can create narratives, symbols, iconographies, patterns to affect the way you think, feel, and act. It's not science fiction. It's real. China calls this one of their three warfares: psychological operations, media, and law. And the Chinese triple helix protects these types of scientific and technological developments under the veil of commercial entities and intellectual property laws. So, in many ways, it's requiring a stance on our part, the United States and our international economic, technological, and military intelligence allies, to engage a process known as deep surveillance, which is a nice way of saying we have to go high side. Because the regular superficial surveillance of pulsing literature, development, talent flow is not indicative of the actual capability that is being rendered here. And they're not alone. As you can see from the slide we have here, our transatlantic competitor is also deeply involved in this space, although their posture is a bit different. They're far more clandestine and less overt. They don't necessarily make the same claims about outward and very capable resituation of going to be their global position in the next 5 years. But just based upon the effects of the election that occurred in 2016, you know they're capable of doing these things. And the amount of information that is also viable and available to these individuals and their proxies of personal and collective value is growing. One of the other issues that comes to the fore that is very important is, what does this actually mean in the way we use the AI? Is anybody familiar with a program that's begun here in the United States called the Replicator Program? Show of hands. It's a DoD program to be able to create autonomous devices that are then usable in various forms of both kinetic and non-kinetic engagements. That's a really fancy way. You familiar with that? Can you tell us a little bit about that? That's it. But not just drones. Autonomous drones. Drones that are essentially programmable to do something and then release them. Which is interesting, because the stance for autonomous drones across a variety of different media, whether it be unmanned aerial vehicles, surface vehicles, maritime vehicles, essentially reflects the underlying philosophy of how these devices should be developed and used. We in the, quote, West are very comfortable, if not feel very secure, with humans being in the loop, particularly when it comes to things that engage the possibility of weapon system use or whatever other form of human interface is going to be involved that could be either beneficial, burdensome, or injurious. Yeah? we like this very much. However, increasingly what we're realizing is that humans are, at least in part, a relatively weak link in the articulative chain, if for nothing else, based upon decision speed. The information has to come back to the human user, has to be integrated through a set of human channels, has to be fed back to the device, and then the device has to articulate and implement. Sometimes you just don't have that kind of wiggle room. However, a human on the loop might be able to provide that in a proactive way where the system is essentially what we call prescinding. In other words, stepping out of itself to give a God's eye view. This is what's going to happen next. Heads up, human. You're on the loop. Be aware. We need to call you in now. So in other words, you're waiting outside the door for the machine to go squawk. In you come and go, oh, now we've got an issue. Let's deal with this. That's on the loop. However, increasingly in international circles that deal with this type of technology, humans are out of the loop. Why? Because humans are seen as an impediment to the iterative progress of the instrumentative development of these technologies. Why put in human builder biases when those builder biases essentially fold in all the foils and foibles of human decision-making process when we're leaning on the machine to do something that we want it to do better than us, but what we're really doing is we're hobbling the machine to do that. That would be sort of like putting great shoes on the horse and then making sure the horse runs to my own pace. Huh? Our Trans-Pacific near competitors are married to the idea of humans out of the loop for any and all forms of AI. And the reason is simple. Because they actually feel and have stated explicitly in the literature, both technical literature as well as philosophical, political literature dealing with science and technological development, that humans out of the loop carry only the primary directive of the initial human in the loop, which is basically a political directive that then allows these machine systems to articulate, not my term, pure cognition. Pure cognition. Now, is that inherently problematic? Is that, as we like to say in the medical, legal, and ethical legal realm, malum in se, bad unto itself? No, not necessarily. And part of the problem is defining what is bad unto itself and what is not, and how these things are going to be used, which obviously poses the issue of security, risks, and potential threats for which all of these systems taken either individually or, more realistically, in combination, pose. Look at what these things are capable of doing. These are all of the downrange, real-world, viable options that these systems, as they exist in 2023, essentially accommodate and operationalize. Massive data and multi-level and situational surveillance. This gets back to the human terrain teaming, tracking, and naked person viability and tracking. Real-time. Number two, security and defense gaming to a level and extent that heretofore was not possible, which now allows us to map, identify, access, and affect potential competitors, adversaries, vulnerabilities. And those vulnerabilities then allow for an increased level and fidelity and granulation of what's called vulnerabilization of competitors and foes. In other words, if I just look at this individual, I may think this is a naval aviator, completely without any weaknesses whatsoever, knowing that community well, flawless, perfect in all iterations of cognition, emotion, behavior, and physiology. Easy. Come on now.
Yes, I know him.
All right, there you go. And I can say, well, sitting right next to him, look at a trident. Absolutely, this represents the pinnacle of the Special Operations Command community of the United States Navy. Obviously, just as flawless in so many different ways. We're not even going to go into subby stuff, but that's different. It's okay, don't worry about it, we'll get there. And one might make that assumption based upon, literally, performance records, history, training, etc. And as tongue-in-cheek as that is, but what if I really knew that he was afraid of spiders? Or the moon? Seriously. Something what appeared to be benign and infinitesimal. What it allows me to do is target individual vulnerabilities. And by targeting those vulnerabilities, what have I got? I got the weakest link, albeit a nano chink in that chain, by which I can then manipulate. And if I can access it, I can affect it. Can I assess it? Absolutely I can. But there's more than that. One of the things I might also be able to do is manipulate data in such a way as to make it seem as if His particular arachnophobia, or the fact that this gentleman is afraid of the moon, has been a long-standing psychiatric problem throughout their family and has debilitated their family in so many ways that obviously makes this individual very, very vulnerable if placed in a high-security situation, because all Ivan has to do is show them, look, nasty spider, next thing you know, boom, he's going to be spilling his gut. And he comes back and says, that's never happened in my family. I've never had a complete decompensation, anxiety profile, PTSD, because I was attacked by a spider. Oh, yes, you do. It's right here in your data. I have your data. But that's not real. Prove it. Prove it. Now, I'm being really overt, but it could be something like your medical record, where your vulnerabilities lie. Are you qualified for service? Are you qualified to hold a clearance? Are you qualified to vote? Is there a criminal record in your past? A psychiatric record in your past that might be physically non-qualifying? Do you have an existing medical condition that requires treatment path alpha, when in fact you don't have that condition and you really need treatment path bravo? Now what's happening is you're getting all the wrong treatment. And speaking of treatment, if I know what makes you tick, if I know where your vulnerabilities lie, I can also utilize all of these big data AI systems together with some of the state-of-the-art synthetic bio and gene editing techniques to be able to develop precision pathologies. Designer bugs. Everything I have read, no guilty knowledge here, it's now low side, both high side and now low, about SARS-CoV, the SARS virus that created the global pandemic that we just have gone through and continue to go through, indicates that this was not an intentionally manufactured biological weapon per se. It was a hiccup in the biosecurity level of laboratories that were doing something called gain-of-function research. The wake-up call is, we can do this! Fast, fast. We can also redirect narratives. I had the pleasure and honor of being involved in a DARPA program called Narrative Networks, that by understanding how individuals' brains work in response to various cognitive patterns, cognitive stimuli, and then clumping them together in big data AI patterned ways, we can understand what sort of trips your trigger, what tickles your Twinkie, what lights your fire, what pisses you off. And as a result, what I can then do is manipulate various narratives and symbols to do that. You don't believe me? Look at TikTok. And of course, now we go back to the idea of autonomous weapon systems. Being prepared for this doesn't mean we can't go forward with this. Doesn't mean that we have to prohibit research, technology, development and use among the United States and our international market, technology, and military intelligence allies. But what it does mean is we have to go through with a process of being prepared to go there. In other words, we must be focused, flexible, fast-moving, and rapidly adapting. It's the only way we can move forward. We don't want to prevent the good things that come out of this, if you will, jar of genies, but by the same token, we don't want the gremlins to come out, nor do you want to sprinkle them with water at midnight. One of the things we've advocated is what we call the SMART approach. Obviously, administration, management, security, education, training, sort of like voting in Chicago, early and often throughout individuals' career, militarily and otherwise. But one of the things you also have to be aware of is that as deeply nested as this is in understanding the science and technology, it cannot nor should not be extricated from the philosophical, cultural, and ethical frameworks in which it lives. Our international peer competitors have learned to utilize their longstanding cultural histories, philosophies, and ethics to profound scientific and technological global advantage. I've sat on those committees. I've listened to the rhetoric, and it goes like this. Yes, for hundreds of years, the West was the predominant force with regard to worldwide science, technology, and philosophy, because the West has failed to recognize the cultural appropriateness and probity of the long-standing Chinese culture that has existed for thousands of years, which, to our view, from inside China, is just as important, just as sentinel and salient as the long-standing Western philosophical tradition that you hold near and dear. And, by the way, part of that Western tradition is an openness to multiculturalism and a relative embrace of sort of cultural concerns and responsivity. Why are you not doing that now? And I'll tell you why you're not doing that now, because it puts you in a decremented position, because you're not allowing us to respect our ethics that's somewhat more permissive than your own, even in terms of definitions of what constitutes basic human rights and what needs to be repaid back to the collective, the community, the state, so as they're able to reinstate one's human rights as a human. And there are ways to do that. One can be involved in human research, for example, and or various forms of service. That permissiveness is also open worldwide. Come to here, wherever here may be. I'm using China as an example. And you can get a lot of work done that you couldn't ordinarily get done in your own country. Is that ethics dumping, or is that scientific and technological opportunization? But the bottom line of that is it also then becomes Chinese intellectual property, which then leverages these non-kinetic markets in these particular ways. So how do we go forward? I'm going to tell you how you go forward. At least I'm going to give you the ticket. And the ticket starts right here. Cash the reality check. Nothing I have told you in this brief is science fictional. It's all science factual. Nothing that I've told you here is cultural clutter. It all represents cultural and cosmopolitan realities of the 21st century global stage. In these domains of science and technology that are leverageable across a variety of others and are certainly actionable in those ways that we feel poses at least some potential risk, if not clear and present threats and dangers to various domains of national security, intelligence, and defense. That kind of realistic insight is going to be important. Savvy to the actual technology and the economics, equally important. Building security by design into each and all of these domains of the science and technology as a component of not only their creation, but their sustainment in terms of the edifice and enterprise that they execute, and also being responsive to these global ethics. Ethics needs to be an inextricable part of any and all education, research, and training in these dimensions so as to be able to be operative in a realistic way on the global stage of the 21st century.